You are listening to The Truth Disciple, a show where logic, critical thinking, and today's current events collide.
This episode is sponsored by Swanson Health. Swanson Health has been producing quality vitamins, supplements, and foods for over 50 years in the heart of America. Swanson Health is the only company to offer the full spectrum of wellness products for the mind, the body, and the home. From quality vitamins and supplements to the cruelty-free beauty items, Swanson Health is here to keep your mind and body healthy. Swanson vitamins and supplements are crafted in the USA and are made with unsurpassed purity and potency. Swanson Health carries over 20,000 wellness products at a great value. Pick up all your favorite wellness health products, plus discover the new ones for your wellness routine, all while leaving your money in your pocket. If you want to try out any of Swanson's new products and great products, use my promo code TRUE20 for 20% off Swanson's website and let me know what you got. Thank you so much. Have a great day. What's up, everyone? How are you guys doing? I'm here with Jesse from Voluntary Vixens, and my name is The Truth Disciple.
Hi, I'm Jesse with the Voluntary Vixens. Maddie's not with me today, so.
It's just us.
Yep.
It's going to be a great episode.
I actually reached out to you, I guess it was about a month ago, just because I started thinking about, with all the stuff that was going on with COVID, I thought maybe we need to have a discussion about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. Because I feel like maybe most Americans don't really know what exactly happened with that. So you said you were excited about doing it. So
I love the idea. It's such an important topic to hit, especially in a time like this, when we're talking about COVID testing on African people. It's definitely such a experiment to hit because it means so much to our country. It means so much because it built and founded so many things on ethics, on guidelines. And those people and their ancestors are still getting affected with that experiment today. I think it was 19 of their lineage is still getting affected today because that settlement of 10 million isn't enough. It's not enough for 40 years.
And it didn't
years
cover everybody
trauma.
Either.
Exactly. We still need to talk about this because the only thing that the American government did to take part in this or to at least try and help the people who face this and who actually need help is they only gave a public apology by what's his name? Bill Clinton only gave a public apology and he thought that was enough. Then a couple of years later, Obama gave a public apology. What is that going to do? And that wasn't the first or the last.
Yeah.
So I
was going
to
ask you about that actually later on. But since you're talking about it, I was going to ask, like, do you think that apology helped at all?
No, not really. Give an apology in front of American people. Yes, you're acknowledging it, but you're not really truly trying to help those who were affected. What is that going to do to that family and to those multiple families of those 600 people? What is that going to do?
Right.
And giving an award on stage, I don't see much in that. I'm just being honest. What about you?
All right. I don't think I'm allowed to have an opinion on that because I'm a white woman. So, but I do feel like, I think that, well, I feel like apologies mean you're sorry and you're never going to do it again. But we were just talking earlier that the government has they've done a lot of things since then. So
you can't truly be apologetic when you keep on repeating that same act. You've repeated it in multiple continents and in multiple regions and over multiple centuries. Then how are you apologetic for your actions? You keep on doing it. That's kind of psychopathic behavior and thinking if you truly believe what you're doing is wrong, but you keep on doing it. It's crazy.
And I also think, considering that Bill Clinton wasn't the one that did the study, why was he apologizing for something he didn't do? I never have understood that.
Exactly.
How has it helped to get an apology from somebody that never did anything to you? I don't know how that makes you feel better. But I was telling Truth, you know, before we started recording, you know, how I first heard about the Tuskegee experiment. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, like, a lot of white people don't really even, I mean, it's not, we don't get taught this information unless we're in healthcare. And even when we do, it's a very like short and sweet example of like why we have to get informed consent from our patients, why we have to make sure we, when we like do procedures, or in my case, when I was doing therapy, that we have the consent of the family to talk to their child who's a minor, or involve them in the process of any medications or any types of other types of therapies. So mm-hmm. It's never really like explained to us the depth of what happened. But my first experiment or experience with understanding what the Tuskegee experiment was about was I was a therapist in a psychiatric hospital, and I worked on the adolescent unit. We had a lot of kids come in with suicidal thinking, and teenagers they're under a lot of stress these days. And I had this one young woman who, she's about 16, came in, and she happened to be an African-American, and we were about to discharge her. She was doing well, and we had to do our wrap up family session. So her father came in. And so I was kind of just going over with him. I was like, here's the problem. Here's what's been happening. This is what she's been saying. And this is the things that we are hoping that outpatient therapy will do. And he was just getting more and more angry as I was talking. And I just couldn't figure out what I was saying that was making him so mad. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I happened to, at the very same time, be training another therapist who was going to start working with us. And she happened to be African-American too. So it was kind of nice how this turned out. So she actually kind of helped explain some of the things I was trying to say in a much more diplomatic way. Cause here I am, I was in my early 20s, you know, so I'm pretty much a kid myself, trying to explain to this grown man, like, what's wrong with his daughter. And he's like, what, you know, he's like, who are you? and he even said, there's nothing wrong with my daughter. And so I was like, huh, she did kind of say she was suicidal. So that's kind of a problem.
I think that's a huge problem.
So, yeah. So in the background with her too, is that his daughter was actually a really smart, really bright young woman. She was actually doing really good in school. So the fact that she was even suicidal was a surprise to everyone in her family for that reason, because they thought she was doing so well. But the therapist, you know, kind of smoothed things over, that the one I was training, she kind of smoothed things over with him. And then she came back and explained to me, you know, the Tuskegee experiment and how it has affected how Black people view healthcare workers. Mm-hmm. And still, she didn't give me a lot of information, but after she kind of explained like what it was, I understood now, like whenever I work with somebody who is African-American, I have to be, you know, a little bit more understanding and be more careful of how I word things, which, I mean, that's just the way it is when you work mm-hmm. in that type of setting. So, years have gone by, and, you know, I've became a nurse, and we have studied, I remember, you know, watching a documentary about the nurse that was involved in the study, Miss Rivers, and just kind of how her role in the whole study, and really how she was kind of used by the people running the study to keep the patients, the subjects, more comfortable and keep them in the study. And, but that really was about it until all this stuff just started coming up with COVID, you know, all these, we can't get out of it. We're not going to be able to go back to a normal life until we have a vaccine. We'll never have a normal again. This is the new normal. We're going to be socially distancing and wearing masks all our lives. I mean, that's kind of the message I was getting. And it was just making me so frustrated, because I don't know about you, Truth, but I just feel like we've way overestimated the danger of COVID to the point where I think the government is sort of using it to more or less see and test the waters and how much they can control us and what we're willing, what freedoms we're willing to give up. And I started thinking about this experiment. Like, it just popped in my mind. And I was thinking, like, that's exactly what they did to these subjects. They lied to them. They told them that they were treating them when they really weren't.
Getting free healthcare.
And so, yeah. Free, they're getting free healthcare.
For their bad blood, quote unquote.
Yeah, for bad blood. That's what they called it back then. So, I don't know. Do you want to add anything right now from your, any early stories?
The first time I heard about the experiment, I'm not really sure when I heard of it, but I just think I was doing research about different things that have happened in the past in American history. And I probably just happened to cross paths on the topic. And so I definitely did more research. I wanted to learn more about this study because it wasn't too long ago and it's still relevant to till this day. So I just wanted to learn more, get more details and just see why everything played out the way it did, because it could have been stopped. A year, 2 years, 3 years, they could have stopped it, but they chose to let it go for 40 plus years. That tells you a lot about our government.
Yes. And I just think, you know, let's just be real. Like, the mentality of people at that time was not that great. You know, it was still a very racist time in history.
Definitely.
So, that's you know, let's just, that's just the reality of it.
That's what plays a major part in it as well.
Yes, because, one of the things that the doctors, I think it was Dr. Vondelet, I can't remember how to say his name, but one of the things that he said was that these black subjects in Alabama were the perfect subjects because they were so compliant and they never asked questions. They just did everything that you told them to. And that
because they trusted them. They trusted them.
Yeah. Yeah. So
they thought they would have their best interest in heart, and they didn't.
And that's the part I think where I started getting kind of, I was listening to a podcast about this. And I'll link the podcast to you guys in our show notes so that you guys can listen to it if you guys want to, because it's good. It does a pretty good detailed breakdown. It's a 4-part series. So be sure, if you have the time, it's a long, long one, but it's worth a listen. I'm trying to see here. Theodore. Yep. So I kind of wanted to go, I don't know, did you want to say anything else? Because I was just going to go over the timeline of the experiment, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, before that, can I actually ask you a question?
Sure.
So how does learning about this tragic experiment make you feel about the system we're in? Like, how does that make you feel as a healthcare worker about our system, about the values we used to have and we currently have? How does that make you feel?
Well, if you've ever listened to any of our other episodes, I'm not a big fan of our government or our healthcare system at all. And I think a large part of the problem lies in our government, because the government is trying to take control over something that they don't need to. Healthcare, I think healthcare can be run by, it should be run by doctors and other healthcare professionals, not by the government. We're the ones that go to school to learn how to take care of patients. We're the ones that, you know, we go into the field to get to know our patients and help people. We don't want to spend 99% of our time, you know, checking boxes and making sure our documentation is just right so that we'll get reimbursed by insurance companies. You know, we'd much rather spend our time talking to our patients and having the time to do like our physical assessments and get into background and focus more on, instead of what's making them sick, how to prevent them from getting sick, how to live a healthy lifestyle, that kind of stuff. But that's not how our healthcare system's set up. And our government prevents it from being that way. And insurance companies prevent it from being that way too. So yeah, I'm not a huge fan. And I think it lends itself to a lot of abuse. You know, where people who, this is what I'm saying, like, and it doesn't matter what color of skin you are. If you are just a very trusting person and you don't question anything, you end up being a victim of the system.
Definitely.
And it, because I've seen poor white, like I live in East Tennessee, so I see a lot of real poor rural Appalachian people who are the same way. They, you have a lab coat on, they're going to listen to you, they're going to do what you say. You could tell them to do anything and they'll do it.
Jump off and, a cliff.
Yeah, and they'll hurt themselves for it, you know? It's just really sad. Yeah. And I see people who will spend all their money on medications. Like, I'm talking about people who are diabetic, who are type 2 diabetic, that all you have to do is teach them how to eat healthy and live a better lifestyle. And they're going to spend, but instead, we just focus on the symptoms. So we just tell them, take your insulin, here's your prescription, bye. And they go and they just spend all their money on all the insulin products that they need, instead of maybe like just spending their money on healthier food.
Yeah.
Teaching them not to smoke, you know, getting them through a non-smoking program.
It can go a long way.
Yeah. We could have been spending all our time and attention on things like that, but instead we just make them spend, I mean, some of these people will, they'll still go buy their pack of cigarettes and they'll still go get their beer and they just will forgo dinner and they'll just take, they'll buy their insulin. And then next thing you know, they're back in the ER because their blood sugars dropped because they didn't eat anything and they're still taking insulin. So it's like, you know, we focus on the wrong thing, is all I'm saying. And definitely, it leads itself to abuse.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. So anyways, are you ready for me to go over the timeline?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So I can't really bring up the Tuskegee anything without talking about Booker T. Washington, because he's basically the founder of the Tuskegee Institute. He's the one that was... I don't know if you know, but he had dinner at the White House. He's the first Black man to ever be invited to the White House and had dinner with Theodore Roosevelt. So that's kind of a big deal, I would say. And he was really, and I would say, according to this timeline, in 1895, he was beginning to start developing ideas about Black economics, trying to... get that started off the ground. He had some philanthropists that were helping him with these ideas to get them off the ground. In 1900, the Tuskegee Educational Experiment is what he started. He started raising money to develop the schools, factories, businesses, and agriculture. In 1915, Booker T. Washington dies, and Robert Moton continues his work. So now we're going to fast forward to 1926. The health initiative is started, and syphilis is becoming a major health problem in the United States. 35% of people in the reproductive age groups are positive for syphilis. So in 1929, they start using mercury and bismuth to treat syphilis, but the problem with both of those are both heavy metals, and it's like a less than 30% cure. And both of those medicines have a lot of side effects and are toxic and sometimes fatal. And I was just thinking, like, mercury has been, when it was used on women, would make them infertile, so they couldn't have children after taking it. So it's really just, it was not a great medication.
Mm-hmm.
And also in 1929, the Wall Street crash happened. And so the Great Depression begins. 1931, Rosenwald funds are cut to support development projects. So these two doctors, Dr. Clark and Dr. Vondelet, they decide to follow men who were left untreated for syphilis during this time. And so they're just kind of basically keeping track of symptoms to show that there is a need for funding.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say they started this thing back in 1931 for a good reason, to be honest. In 1932, a follow-up turned onto the study. They were able to gather up 399 men with syphilis 201 without. Now, these all men, all these men are African-American men, and they are in Alabama. So they're very specific to this group. And a lot of them are sharecroppers and farmers and things like that. Mm-hmm. So they managed to gather up over 500 different men. And they, actually 600 men, sorry. They would be given physicals, and they are told that they're getting treatments. And Moton, who was the one that took up Booker T. Washington's work, he wanted to use the study at the Tuskegee Institute. So he kind of opened the doors to the institute for them to do their study. And the reason why he wanted to do that is also to get credit for the university, and also to have Black health professionals involved in the study as well. So that's where Dr. Dibble and Nurse Rivers comes in. Mm-hmm. 1934, this is in 1934, 2 years after the study was officially started. Some papers came out about the study. They were published about the studies about untreated syphilis. So now we're starting to get some, they're starting to produce some of their findings. 1936, a major study published, which the major study was published, and it was criticized because they didn't know if the men were being treated, but a decision was made by the CDC to continue to follow the men until their death. So that point, I think, like you were saying, it was supposed to be just like a 6 month study.
Yeah, 6 months.
They decided to make it, they wanted it to be until these men die. Okay. All right. So in 1940, efforts were made to hinder men from seeking treatment. So at this time, penicillin was starting to just make waves in the community about how it could be used with as a syphilis. Cure. Yeah. It wasn't officially a cure, but it was being mentioned. So the doctors started to get a little worried, and they were saying, we can't let our subjects know about this. So they were like, let's shut it down. Don't let these people know. Officially in 1945, penicillin was accepted as the treatment for syphilis. So now we know that this is the official treatment for syphilis, but they're still not giving it to any of these subjects. In 1947, the U.S. Public Health Services establishes rapid treatment centers for syphilis. Yet, none of the men in the study were allowed to be part of that. All right, fast forward to 1968. And ethics of the study were finally addressed by Peter Buxton. In 1969, the CDC reaffirms a need for the study. So the CDC, I mean, come on. How many times has people like questioned this, right? Or we've already had a treatment too. The CDC should have just let these people get treatment, but they never did.
They let it go on.
So as late as 1969, CDC reaffirms the need for the study, and they also gained local medical societal support from like the American Medical Association, the National Medical Association. They support the continuation as well. So it's not just the CDC. It's these it's other major, yeah, it's disgusting. That's what it is. 1972, news articles come out and criticize the studies. So it starts to come out. 1973, Congress decides to hold, like a whole year later, Congress decides to hold a hearing about it. And now there's a mass class action suit being filed. In 1974, $10 million out of court settlement was reached. Lifetime medical benefits and burial services to all the living participants. In 1975, the wives and offspring were added to the program. And then in 1995, the program expanded to include health as well as medical benefits. And I don't know what they meant by that. I guess they were...
I don't think they want to think about that, especially since they're especially originally trying to get health benefits in the first place.
Yeah.
It's kind of ironic.
1997, President Bill Clinton officially apologizes for everyone. So, after that, they've had reward ceremonies, memorials, and things like that. But that's pretty much the timeline. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's just, I mean, it basically started, the need for it began in 1931. And it ended in, let's see, 1973.
Jeez.
That's pretty disgusting.
It was supposed to last 6 months.
Mm-hmm. And when they knew that they, I mean, it was well known that penicillin was a treatment for syphilis, they still, they never gave, offered to give any of the subjects syphilis.
Yeah, they knew. I mean, they wanted to hide the cure so he could keep going. But at the in the end, what did they need to know? What was the goal?
When because, I was listening,
go ahead.
I was listening to the podcast that was talking about it. I mean, there's one doctor. Oh my goodness, let me look it up real quick. It's not, I don't know if it was Dr. Vondelet, because I think he was pretty much out of the study by that point. To me, it just sounds like, this is why I think that scientists are sort of crazy.
Mm-hmm. They want to see how far they can go with it.
Yeah, they just, it's not about like, the study is not about like improving anything. It's just they're curious about what
the effects on the body.
Yeah, he was curious about the late stage effects of syphilis in the on the brain and what they would do. And now this was in the timeline, it wasn't added in there, but what they would do even. Now, not only would they not tell them about a treatment and they would just claim that they're taking care of all their other needs, which they kind of did, but they would make them get spinal taps and they would subject them to, you know, taking their blood a lot, things like that. And just tell them that they're just doing it because they have bad blood.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't tell them because they never told these patients that they had syphilis. And
so
and then
did
when
they
patients
not notice,
died.
Did they not well, notice like the side effects of the actual syphilis? Because some actually already had it. So they might have thought yeah. it was just normal. I'm guessing.
Yeah. And sometimes like the thing about syphilis is that you can, it will lie dormant in your body for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So you may not necessarily, like you might have the lesions, but you're not going to have like all the other things. The late stage is when you start seeing people who are going, who are having like level of consciousness type changes.
Mm-hmm.
They
the physical
might have,
effects.
Yeah, more physical effects. And then that's what they were more interested in. They wanted to see the really late stages. What they would do is after a patient died, they would then ask the family to let them do an autopsy. And they wouldn't tell them why they wanted to do an autopsy, but the reason why is they wanted to look at their brains and see the effect of the syphilis on their brain. Now, like you asked earlier, like why? When you already know the cure, why would you need to know that? I mean, it's just... to me, it just sounds insane. Like, it just seems like you're like, now you're a crazy psychopath.
It's just a game. It's basically just a game. And you just want to see how far it can take it and how far it's going to affect these people who are innocent.
Yeah.
And abusing your power as well and your position.
And I would say, I'm even going to say, even go further to just say, like, I don't necessarily know if they were necessarily... they wanted to do harm. I just mm-hmm. don't think they cared that they were doing harm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're so far removed from it. Now, some people criticize Miss Rivers, the nurse, and Dr. Dibble because they were African Americans involved in the study too. But I would think, now I know that there was a couple of times where it was said that she did, you know, ask questions like, why do we need to do spinal taps on everybody? And she was just told not to ask questions, just record the data. And I would think, you know, I don't think that they were, I think that they were either so far removed from the whole process, like they probably weren't given all the information themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know that Eunice Rivers wasn't given all the information. She was just there to basically treat the patient while they were there and you know, do their assessments and things like that. And then just write down the numbers. But I would think in Dr. Dibble's case, I think he was kind of kind of stuck in a hard place because he really wants to, he's a African-American doctor at a time when that's not common. And he wants that to be more common. He wants more young Black people to go to medical school, become doctors. And if he messes this up, he might mess up not only his chance to be part of a major study or the Tuskegee Institute to be part of the study, but he may dissuade young African Americans from, you know, going to medical school. So he kind of is kind of stuck in a hard place, you know?
I bet.
So I don't know. What are your thoughts, you think, on that?
I definitely agree with you because the Tuskegee Institute was also at a hard time. They were early in the institute, and actually just wanted notoriety to get started. Like, the plan was to get notoriety to build upon this and to hopefully find reasoning and the reasoning behind the cure and et cetera, and actually help the institution. But what ended up happening is the study produced nothing. That's what ended up happening, because actually researched and found that they wanted to open up a museum after the entire study was going to take place to display everything that happened. So yeah, that's another part of it, another layer to talk about as well, because they wanted to ingrain it into the culture of the university as well.
Yeah, that's just so sad. The whole thing. I don't know. I was listening to a guy talking about the doctor who discovered the AIDS virus. He kind of discovered it on accident. And he was talking about how these scientists are not humanists. Like, they don't care about the individual human being. They just care about the study, and they just care about the data that they're looking at.
And what it's going to prove.
Yes. And that, doesn't that kind of sound, I mean, I hate to go back to the COVID thing, but doesn't that kind of sound like what Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci were doing when they're like in the very early stages of this pandemic? They're talking about, we have to shut down everything, stay indoors, because the numbers are going to be really high. And so their only concern is about keeping those numbers low.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't think about all the people that would commit suicide, all the domestic violence situations, all the children who would go without food because they can't go to school now, and they relied on the public school system for food. They didn't think about any of all these other major things, that more things than I can even mention. They just had this, they were just thinking about one particular thing, and that was the COVID numbers.
Reducing the numbers. That's it.
And that's kind of what I think happened here. And on top of that, like, you know,
but the bad certainly outweighs the good. No question about it.
Yes.
There's no question.
I was looking at the doctors that were all involved, or the healthcare professionals involved. See, like Dr. Clark, Taliaferro Clark. He's the one that started the study. And then Dr. Vondelier, he took off after that. And then it was Dr. John Heller. And he was the one that in 1972, like, they interviewed him for an article and he defended the study. He didn't think that anybody was doing anything wrong. And then Nurse Rivers, and then Dr. Dibble. Dr. Dibble's the one that was, he wanted the experiment to happen on the campus Tuskegee Institute. Another doctor that was involved was Dr. Wanger, and he was a public health doctor in a clinic in Alaska, and he was really, he was studying syphilis as well, so he was part of the study. But just thinking about how we as a society, we trust doctors with our health so much. And I don't know. Do you think that maybe we might be a little bit too trusting of our healthcare professionals?
Yeah, I actually had, like, before, I would actually wonder, when you get your blood drawn, where does that go? Like, actually, when you're at a clinic or at a doctor's office and they're just checking your blood, after they're done checking it, where does it actually go? And I think you can answer that.
Oh, wow.
I was just curious.
I never really thought about that because, you know, as a nurse, like we in the hospital, and sometimes when I would do home hospice and stuff, we would draw labs and we'd take it to the lab mm-hmm. and we just drop it off. So the lab would be the ones that, you know, the people that were testing the blood. I wonder if they even,
oh wow,
I'm sure they, I know I've seen like all those gigantic biohazard bags filled with, you know, the lab tubes that we use.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. But, you know, I mean, if like you really wanted to go down like a conspiracy rabbit hole, that would be a really dangerous one to, like, I don't even want to know like what
they
happens.
Do with my blood.
Like it may just like all our DNA is like probably we all our DNA is banked somewhere.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much a given.
Our spit, our blood.
Yeah. And that's all they really need is our hair, spit, and blood.
Yeah. It's not hard to get.
At and all. They can make a new one of us. They can clone us all.
I'm sure they have.
It's scary to think about. But yeah, I mean, what do you, I mean, do you feel like, I mean, I had to kind of ask you, like, do you feel like the African American community knows about this study well enough to, does it make them paranoid of doctors? And because in my experience, not only as a therapist, but when I became a nurse, I still saw some of that. And I don't know.
I don't think it's directly because of this, but specifically speaking on this study and the Tuskegee experiment, I don't think the average African-American typically knows about this and was taught about this in their family and school, because it took me learning this on my own through the internet to know about the study. If I didn't know about this and research different topics like this, I wouldn't have known about this this experiment at all, because they don't teach you this in school. It's not passed down. You have to go out and search it for yourself. And so I don't think the average African-American in this country currently knows about experiments like this, knows about King Leopold and what he did to Congo, like we already discussed. I don't think, mm-hmm. I really don't think the average African-American or American knows about things like that. Ignorance can be very bliss.
It can be, but like, you know, what ends up happening though is
once you end up being
part of a horrible study where yeah. you end up with syphilis at the end of it. I mean, and that could not necessarily that as a metaphor, but I mean, it's like I was just thinking about the COVID stuff. One thing that really just drove me crazy, because even my husband is very paranoid as well about the stuff. And he's even said to me, he's like, I'm not going to feel comfortable until we have a vaccine. And I kid you not, like, there's a lot of people that they just will not feel comfortable until we have a vaccine. And I find that to be scary, how many people are willing to get shot up with something they don't even know that's in it. Yeah.
And they haven't tested correctly.
Yeah. It's supposed to take years before a vaccine is developed.
Yeah.
Now, if they say, here's a question that you have to ask yourself. If they say that the vaccine has been thoroughly studied and is ready to be produced and given to people, then you need to ask yourself, well, how do they have enough time to make a vaccine off of this virus if it just came out this year? So either they're lying about that, or they have been making this virus in a lab somewhere and developing a vaccine at the same time for a long time and testing it on someone or some people for a long time. Yeah, before this. Those are the two options that you have. Like, I don't know. Is there another option? I mean, those are the two things. Those are the two scenarios that seem to be the only two scenarios in my head that are plausible. And none of those scenarios sound very good.
Mm-hmm.
Because like, it takes doesn't years. Make me trust our government more. And especially, and so that kind of leads me to my next thing. Like, our government hasn't learned its lesson. The CDC should have learned its lesson after this, that we cannot experiment on people like they're lab rats. We have to inform them of what they're being studied. We have to give them their diagnosis. If there is a treatment for it, then we have to offer that treatment to the patient. And especially if a patient dies and we want to do an autopsy, we have to tell the family exactly why we want to do the autopsy.
Exactly.
Because some people are very sensitive about that. And some people don't even know what an autopsy is. And that was one of the things that Nurse Rivers would run into, is that a lot of these families did not even understand what an autopsy was. So if they were, and they were just told simply, oh, it's just like a surgery, but they're, but they'll be passed away while we're doing the surgery. And they don't know what that means either. And so they'll agree to it. And they don't realize, like, this guy is going to take a saw and cut open their loved one's head, take their brain out, cut it up in little pieces. And that may be very disturbing to some people.
To most people.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
To me, I'm thinking like, well, if you do it to me, I'm dead. I can't even care if I wanted to. But to maybe my husband, he probably doesn't want that to happen to my body. I don't know. But, you know, it's just one of those things where you, there was just no respect given to the families. People. Or the patients themselves. So anyway, so what I was going to say is that since then, there have been some other experiments that have been done. John Hopkins actually right now is in a lawsuit for over $1 billion right now in its role in a study of subjects in Guatemala. They studied 800 subjects and their families, just experiments involving infecting people with syphilis, gonorrhea, and other STDs.
Oh, wow.
Other organizations that were named within this lawsuit is the Rockefeller Foundation and Bristol Myers Squibb. And I'm just curious, like, how does the Rockefeller Foundation end up in so many of these types of conspiracies? And this is in this conspiracy that actually happens. I don't know why I'm saying conspiracy. But I just find that strange.
Exactly. And who ends up in a lot of these conspiracies as well? A lot of them. And I actually want to touch on one later on.
Okay.
Yeah.
The study in Guatemala, I mean, it's just like, ugh.
How many people died? Or were they just, like, what are the specifics?
Let's see. It says, for more than half a century, since the time of the Guatemala study, scholars, ethicists, and clinicians have worked with government officials to establish, this is just the Hopkins spokeswoman. They're trying to say that they were doing rigorous ethical standards of human research, whatever. Let's see. This article that I found in the Baltimore Sun that talks about this. Let's see, what year was this? April 1st, 2015. Okay.
Oh, wow.
The Guatemala experiments have been compared to the infamous Tuskegee syphilis experiments, which prompted creation of much of the ethical and legal standards that we have to use here in the United States. In Guatemala, however, the researchers deliberately infected the subjects with syphilis, gonorrhea, and chancroid from 1946 to 1948. In some cases, when the male subjects did not become infected with syphilis after having sex with prostitutes who had the disease, researchers exposed the bacteria to wounds on their faces or penises.
Oh my gosh.
Participants in the study included psychological patients and prison inmates, orphans, and children who attended state-run schools. This is just heartbreaking. This is so heartbreaking.
It's disgusting.
Oh my God. These are just the people that nobody cares about, quote unquote, right?
Prisoners, orphans, they have no one.
People who are psychologically, you know, damaged in some way.
Mm-hmm.
This is sad. Kind
of been through something.
Which, they're expendable. By the way, yeah. I'm just going to say that's a variable that you don't, these are not healthy people in the first place. They're not a good study.
Yeah, because they're not the average person.
You're taking people who don't live healthy lifestyles in the first place and may not necessarily, because if they have a psychological type of issue, they may have other underlying issues that you don't know about.
And that could possibly affect the experiment and the outcome.
Not a good experiment study.
And it's also not universal.
Yeah. So that's disgusting. All right. And then we also talked about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. There is a study. There's a couple things with them, actually. I have it saved in my notes under other shady businesses. That's the notes I have. So I found this article called, hold on. I had to look at this through my Brave search engine because Google wouldn't pick this up. I would have had to scroll and scroll and scroll. So the article's name, title is India Holds Bill Gates Accountable for His Vaccine Crimes. And this was an article written in 2014. Let's see. He did a couple things here. I'm sorry, I hate to be like so quiet.
You're good.
One such country is India, where the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and their vaccine empire are under fire, including pending lawsuits currently being investigated by the India Supreme Court. And since then, India has decided that they will no longer receive funding from the Bill Gates Foundation or Gavi, any of those foundations that are related to Bill Gates. So the author says, eager to know more, I investigated their story and discovered that the World Health Organization's, the Gates Foundations, and two organizations funded by them, PATH and Gavi. PATH stands for Program for Appropriate Technology in Health, and Gavi stands for Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. They have found themselves under fire after a writ of petition submitted by the Supreme Court of India. So they were saying that they were criminally negligent of trialing vaccines on vulnerable and uneducated, underinformed population in school administrators. So what the study is they went to a tribal area of India, and they were going to study the effects of the HPV vaccine on tribal girls. So they say that the tests in 2009 were carried out on 16,000 tribal school children in the Andhra Pradesh, India, using the human papillomavirus vaccine Gardasil. According to the report written by KP, who I don't know what that stands for, KP. Within a month of receiving the vaccine, many of the children fell ill, and by 2010, five of them had died. A further two children were reported to have died in the Vadodara, Gujarat area, where an estimated 14,000 tribal children were vaccinated with another brand of the HPV vaccine called Cervarix. Shockingly, the report said that many of the consent forms used to vaccinate the girls were signed illegally, either by the wardens from the hostels where many of the girls were resided. A lot of the girls, like in the tribal areas, they'll stay kind of like at a, almost like a boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
So the parents won't really see them for most of the time because they're in school. So the school themselves would just sign them over to these studies, basically. Let's see, the wardens from the hostels, and many of them were using thumbprints because the parents that they did get consent from, the parents were illiterate. They couldn't even read the paperwork that were handed to them, and their signatures were their thumbprints. So this travesty was not discovered until a team of health activists from the non-government organization SAMA, an organization specializing in women's health, decided to investigate what had been going on. According to the report, they were shocked to discover that a total of 120 girls had taken ill, suffering from a variety of symptoms, including epileptic seizures, severe stomach aches, headaches, and mood swings. So, I mean, I could go on, but I think that you get an idea, like, what happened to the poor Indian girls. So, and Gardasil is something that is pushed on kids here in the United States today. Like, that's as shocking. A nurse, that bothers me because I remember following, this is in 2014, so I remember, you know, around the time, right before we're about to go into the election season for 2016, I was following a nursing forum, and a lot of the ER nurses were talking about how your young girls would come into the ER with seizures. And they had just had Gardasil shots.
Are you serious? But,
yes. But they were not allowed to say that it was from the Gardasil shot. And even the ER doctors were like, they would say like they were so frustrated because the doctors were afraid to even write that in the report. So something is going on, like even here, where people can't even talk about that.
Oh my God.
And it's a 3-series shot. Like, you can't just get one shot. You have to go back for like a series. So, anyways. All right. So that was 2009, 2010, tribal India. Now, Bill Gates and his lovely wife are back at it again in 2012 in December in Chad, Africa. In a small village called Goro, I could be saying that wrong, but they studied 500 children. Okay, here's the thing. This is so bad. Okay, situated in the edge of the Sahara Desert, 500 children were locked into their school, threatened that if they did not agree to being forcibly vaccinated with a meningitis A vaccine, that they would receive no further education. These children were vaccinated without their parents' knowledge. This vaccine was an unlicensed product, still going through the third and fourth phases of testing. Within hours, 106 children began to suffer from headaches, vomiting, severe uncontrollable convulsions, and paralysis. The children's wait for the doctor began. They had to wait one full week for a doctor to arrive, while a team of vaccinators proceeded to vaccinate children in other villages. When the doctor finally came, he could do nothing for the children. The team of vaccinators, upon seeing what had happened, fled the village.
They fled?
Mm-hmm. Because they knew they messed up. I'm just thinking, like,
I have no words.
It says right there, within hours, right? Within hours. 106 of the children of 500 in that village. Could see effects. You could see effects within an hour. So why would you go to the next village and do this again?
They didn't care. They didn't care.
So, I don't know. So those are just two studies. I mean, I could.
There's so many other cases of these type of scenarios happening. So many.
There's another one that happened in Islamabad, Pakistan. You want to hear about that one?
Yeah.
2011. All right. Islamabad, a government inquiry was found that a polio vaccine for infants funded by the Global Alliance for Vaccination and Immunization are causing deaths and disabilities in regional countries, including Pakistan. According to the Express Tribune, the main vaccinations in questions were the polio vaccine and the 5-in-1 pentavalent vaccine, which were said to be responsible for the deaths and disabilities of a number of children in Pakistan, India, Sri Lanka, Bhutan, and Japan. Gavi, an organization financed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I mean, the Rockefeller Foundation, the United Nations Children's Fund. Oh my gosh. Why does the Rockefeller Foundation keep popping up everywhere? Anyways, I think we all get the point. I mean, I could keep this article goes on, and I'm gonna post it as one of our show notes too, because people need to read that.
Can I just point something out?
Yeah.
Doing my research, I also found something very, very interesting. There was also there's also a very, very disturbing case of WHO. They actually came to Kenya and they vaccinated 500 Kenyan women. And then after they got vaccinated, they began to get sterile. They started reporting that they couldn't, you know, produce kids. They were having problems with infertility. So this is a long reoccurring thing in Africa and other third world countries and continents, because I think there's a bigger issue. I think there's a bigger underlying issue. Maybe population control, maybe killing off African people, maybe just testing them like monkeys. There's something bigger, especially with WHO, because it keeps on reoccurring. They keep on saying, quote unquote, vaccines are going to be used to these African people, and they give it to them, and they either become sterile, they die, they have huge side effects, or something terrible happens. And these people don't have that right education to decipher whether or not this is the right treatment for them. And other times they confuse them. They say, oh, we have this polio vaccine. And then 3 days later, they're dead. And there's another case in Congo where a doctor came in and gave the supposed COVID vaccine to 7 people in the Congo, and they ended up dying that night.
So they're already testing that vaccine?
Yes, they already started testing it in South Africa recently.
That's disgusting.
And I
don't understand.
And it's especially happening in Africa. And Africa's supposed to be the fastest growing continent. And by 2050, they're supposed to have the most population and the second biggest population in the world. And so Europe and America, we're starting to fall off. You can see the decline in our rates of birth. And I definitely think that plays a part, because if Africans and Asian people are going to be the new majority in this country, in this world, we have to do something about that. Bill Gates is definitely going to do something about that.
Yeah, that's disturbing. That man, there's something so shady about that guy. I wonder how many times he got beat up in high school or something that he just, I don't get it.
He rubs me the wrong way, definitely.
He just comes off creepy anyways. Like, he always came off creepy. But I will say, when I was starting out, like when I was ready to be a nurse and I was going to help everybody, I had all these grand designs of being like I was going to do medical missions. India is a place that I've, you know, done medical missions in before. And I've actually been to some of the tribal areas. And I mean, I will say, they are very trusting. I mean, if you are a white person and you have a lab coat, they'll do whatever you say.
Yeah.
Yeah. We would hold like free clinics for these people, you know, because they don't have access to healthcare. So we would do like a free clinic where we would assess them and give them just basic antibiotics if they had ear infections. And we had one guy who would even do fillings for teeth, because a lot of them had a lot of teeth issues too. And, one of the things I really noticed was just like, they would bring their whole family. They would have all of us check everybody out, because that was like their chance to get healthcare, you know? Yeah. And it's just heartbreaking that they are so trusting. And then somebody like Bill Gates comes in,
just taking advantage,
takes those full advantage people. Of it, and says, we can make a test out of this. We can just test this new vaccine on all these people. So, yeah.
And not even care about their life. And it's not even like it's likely that the vaccine is not going to cause any harm. They know it's more likely going to cause harm than good. They know this is going to happen. They know there are going to be side effects that's going to affect them for a lifetime, but they still don't care.
Now, there's a rumor, and I don't know if it's true out there, that Bill Gates he never got any of his kids vaccinated. And if that is true, why are we listening to him tell us what we should do about vaccines? And why does he care so much about vaccines? You know, because one of the things I was thinking of is, you know, India these people are sick in large part due to the fact that they live in environments that are very dirty.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have clean water. A lot of times they have running sewage going through their villages. Rivers.
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, there's trash everywhere.
Exactly.
So at the very end of the day, if they had access to plumbing and clean water, I wonder if we would even have this problem. And why spend all this money on buying patents for viruses, developing vaccinations, having these labs that nobody's allowed to go into and see and check on the progress of or what you're doing, when you could just use that money towards these, just getting better
people basic healthcare,
water to some of these places,
and a basic life, the basic necessities.
There is like this thing. They are starting to say now, like, the polio vaccine was never really needed, because as our standard of living got better in the United States, the less and less people were getting sick from polio. And they were saying like, maybe we didn't need the vaccine. Maybe we just needed better infrastructure, cleaner water, air, environment, you know,
a better lifestyle.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, like, I mean, I don't know about you, but I know a lot of Indian people, and a lot of them are like, they are very clean, intelligent people. So it's not like they choose to live in trash in their country. If they had a better way to live, they would live it. You know what I'm saying?
Their government and how it's ran.
India's government is very corrupt, has a lot of problems. So
a lot of third world countries suffer from that, especially in Africa.
Yeah. So that's something that maybe like Bill Gates could use his power and influence in that way.
And money.
He chooses not to. And that bothers me.
Instead, he wants to fund vaccines for African children and women. That's interesting.
It's like,
and no one checks him on it. The thing is, no one truly questions him, his motive, why he's doing these to these people. No one cares.
Well, we do, and I think people in our community do, but it's just, we're not a large community, and that's what's sad. I wish more people would. I have found that a lot of people, especially with this whole COVID thing, it's like they just want to blindly believe what the CDC, what Dr. Birx, and what Dr. Fauci say about everything. And I'm like, but just because they're smarter than you, like, they may be legitimately smarter than you, but do you not think that they might have ulterior motive? Like Dr. Fauci, for example, he's been pushing that remdesivir medication, and he's on the board of the company that makes that medication. Like, why is he pushing that?
Exactly. There has to be another reason.
I mean, I just don't get it. Like, a lot of these people think there's a lot of people that say we need to put our mask on and we just need to go and get our vaccines and just be good little citizens and shut up and quit fighting this system. A lot of these people are also like, you know, hand your guns over to the government because you can't be trusted to not kill somebody with a gun. And then they'll just say, like, how can we trust people with that much responsibility? But then you say, but we can trust those guys over there just because they have a PhD behind their name and they work for the World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, they're still people and they still have their, you know, their biases and their problems. So what you're afraid of your neighbor doing, you're not afraid of Dr. Fauci doing? Like, I don't get it.
Why is he so trustworthy? That's the question we should be asking.
But why are we so selective in our trustworthiness? Like, and it's almost like you don't trust yourself even, you know? I find that most of those people, they don't really trust their own judgment. So I'm like, why should I listen to you? But yeah, I am definitely, I don't know about you, but I am definitely still very skeptical about the numbers that are coming out. Like, they're saying that we're having all these surges in positive cases across the country.
I think it was Florida and Arizona that recently came out that their cases have gone to all-time high. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. I guess it's because everything is opening back up. People aren't social distancing. But how long are we going to stay in social distance? How long are we supposed to stay in our houses? There's not a certain timeline or a certain date that this is supposed to be over. So do you guys just want citizens to sit around and do nothing and just be in their house?
I think that's, I mean, I think it's the people that can afford to do that are fine with that. And I just don't know. I'm starting to realize that there's a certain group of people that I guess I really can't relate to. Because I don't think like they do at all, because I like to have my freedom. I like to have spontaneity in my life. I don't want to have to plan every little moment of my day around like how many people are going to be where and how far I need to stand away. And that I have to have a mask in my car at all times.
How many feet?
Yeah. I just don't care about that. And I'm at a point where I'm like, I just kind of wish I could just go ahead and get it so I could get over it, because I'm tired of this mess. But I guess, I don't know. I may have already had it actually, because we got pretty sick in February. So
are you serious?
All of us got sick in February. Like, even my daughter who had the flu vaccine, she was the only one of us that got vaccinated. She still got sick. So I'm thinking, you know, A, vaccines don't really help, or B, we all got coronavirus and we just didn't know it.
And then spread it to other people. Possibly.
Maybe. I don't know.
Hopefully not.
But yeah, so one of the things I'm just thinking too, is that with all the stuff that's been going on in the country lately, you know, we've had a lot of protests against police brutality. A lot of movement, the Black Lives Matter movement has been making a lot of demands. And now we have certain areas in Seattle. And I think, aren't they going to be doing that in New York? They're making their own autonomous zone in New York now. I don't know. I can't remember, but there's just been a lot of racial tension. And so, you know, that's why I even thought the Tuskegee experiment needed to be discussed again, because, you know, that was definitely, this study would not have happened on white people back in the days. Definitely.
And could you imagine, could you imagine the amount of experience that took place during slavery? Could you just imagine? When there weren't any guidelines. Exactly. There weren't any guidelines. No one was saying yes or no. You were just controlled. Could you imagine the amount of experiments that took place? That's crazy.
Oh, I mean, there are stories of things that have happened in the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
That were pretty messed up. But I don't remember that. There's one lady in particular. I don't know if it's a true story or if it's sort of a urban legend type story of a madam that owned a house. Her husband died and she just tortured and just mistreated her slaves up until she died, until they had a rebellion against her. And I can't remember her name. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I haven't heard of that one.
I wasn't planning on talking about that story, so I didn't really look it up, but I mean, I remember that story, and it was she did some really just weird stuff, but I don't know if it's a true story or not, so I don't know. But yeah, I mean, there's stories of just awful things that people do awful things to each other. And so I don't while I still believe that most people try to be good and try to do the right thing, we still need to be vigilant and protect ourselves. That's one of the reasons why me and Maddie are voluntarists, because we really think that personal responsibility is the key to freedom. If you put your your health, your safety, your life in the hands of other people, then you, you know, you run the risk of being used and abused by those people.
Exactly.
So, you know, we talk a lot about like personal responsibility, which is why, you know, when it comes to this whole like police brutality and the racial tensions that are going on, we still focus a lot on the individual, because I think that what's going on right now, I don't think that this is something that all Black people are doing. I think it's just the media trying to make it sound like Black people hate white people right now. Uh-huh. And we all need to be like apologizing. And I don't think that's true of all Black people. I think that we have, I think that actually we've made a lot of strides towards being able to work together and do a lot of things together. But at the end of the day, we have to remember that we're all individuals. So it doesn't matter what color your skin is. It doesn't matter what group you come from. You know, when you're dealing with people one-on-one, you're dealing with them one-on-one.
And their actions speak for themselves. And it's just linked mm-hmm. to that one person.
I mean, we have to address all of the issues that come with a person. So, you know, you have to kind of put aside, and as far as like when I do my job, for example, as a nurse, like when I'm taking care of somebody, I have to put aside, you know, all my biases a lot of times and just like listen to my patients and kind of know what, get to know what they're trying to tell me, what I need to know to take care of them. I have to look at them as an individual. I can't just say, well, he's got a tattoo and so he must be in a biker gang. He's probably got hepatitis C, so I can't touch him. Yeah, I can't go down that whole list of things. I've got to just be like, okay,
I'm just doing my job.
I just got to do my job and just like give people a chance, you know. And I don't think we do enough of that, maybe, you know. I think more and more people are starting to realize that the media is inciting a lot of this stuff, mm-hmm. but there's still a lot of people that get themselves so worked up over what they see on the news. I'm just curious, do you see a lot of that where you live, Truth?
Yeah, I actually see a lot of that. I definitely see a lot of that, because people are taking what the news is saying and posting and they're running with it without mm-hmm. doing prior evidence, without looking and searching. They're just taking the headline and running with it. They're taking what they're saying as a fact instead of searching it up and seeing if it's true.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, like, what area are you from?
I'm from Houston.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What about you?
Well, I'm in East Tennessee, so.
Cool.
Yeah. Where it's like, you know, in my area, like, most of, we do have some, like, racial tensions just because our city is pretty split up. So we have, like, one side of the city is basically, and my city is not like a big city, but it's basically, you know, the good old boys, and then you've got the homeboys, then you've got the scientists that live close to Oak Ridge and they're the well-educated, you know, and then, you know, the everything in between. You know, we actually have, kind of like a hippie population here, kind of weird. I don't know if it's from Asheville, like being close by, but so it's kind of a weird mix of people. But when you venture out into like the wrong neighborhood, you know, it's apparent that you're on the outside, I will say. But I did live in Chicago for a while, and it was sort of similar. Like, you would think Chicago would be a lot more meshed up, you know, because it's a big city and it's very diverse. But they have their neighborhoods. And when I was living there, and you know, I like to go walking around and stuff and just kind of seeing everything, I remember, like, that first year I lived in Chicago, I walked into the wrong neighborhood. And it was clear I was not welcome there. And what happened? I walked back out.
What happened?
Well, where we lived in Chicago was it was sort of a blended, like, we were right by, oh my gosh, I just completely blanked on the name of the university. We were right by one of the universities there, and it's in the north side of Chicago. and Loyola. There you go. We're by Loyola, but the place that we lived in had it basically was a gentrified neighborhood, but we didn't know it. We had thought it was like that for a long time, but basically the guy, like, it used to be a crack house, and he like bought all these crack houses on the same street and just fixed them up. And what we found out is like some people were like coming back to their crack house after they got out of prison and trying to go in people's homes, but they were in now somebody's apartment. So it was kind of a weird neighborhood. It was fine during the day, but at night it got a little bit creepy still. And you would think, because guns are illegal in Chicago, you're not allowed to have a gun, that it would be pretty quiet and you wouldn't hear any gunshots, but that's not the truth. So, a lot of violence, mostly at night, but we were kind of in a weird place where it was like, we kind of stayed away from most of that. But then, if you go walk a little bit further down, it was more, there was the Hispanic neighborhood that was by us. And then if you go through the Hispanic neighborhood, then you get into like more of a Black neighborhood. The Hispanic people tolerated us, but you know, they weren't really super friendly. But when we went into the Black neighborhood, it was like, what are you doing here? Like, they wouldn't smile at you. They wouldn't acknowledge you. They were like, get out. So we got out. But it's like they wanted to come to us, but they didn't want us to come to them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we just kind of like realized that's how Chicago is. It's just, you know, there's some places where everybody kind of meets together in the middle.
But it integrates.
Yeah, to integrate, but they like to go to their own places.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely
have their own
like,
spaces.
There's like a Pakistani neighborhood. There's the Indian neighborhood. There's the Korean. You know, it was like, and it's great. Like some communities were a lot more, you know, letting us come in and see things. Like I really liked going through the Indian areas. Devon Street had a lot of really great Indian restaurants. I had a really good Indian friend when I lived there, so she showed me all the good places. And the Pakistani area was great, and even the Korean area was great. They were a lot more, I guess, open-minded. But I can kind of understand, because in the Black neighborhoods, when white people show up there, either they're about to be like priced out of their homes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they don't want to have anything to do with you, because if something happens to you, they don't want to be like accused of it, because the cops there are really corrupt.
Yeah, I agree.
So the Chicago police, I can't even tell you like how useless and pointless they are. Like, can't.
There's so much to talk about that. There's so much to talk about that.
And see, I was so naive when I went to Chicago. When we moved away from Chicago, that's when all these news articles talking about people like just dying all the time. And I remember the news just being crazy over there, but I was like, well, there's a lot more people that live here and it's a bigger city.
How many years did you live there?
Oh, we only lived there for like maybe a little over 2 years, because we were going there for graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
So we were poor as all get out when we live there, but Chicago is like, it would be a great city to live in, I think, if you're really rich. But other than that, it's not that great.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. A lot of good restaurants, though. Yeah. If you like to eat ethnic food, you could literally like eat at a different ethnic restaurant every night of the day of the year and still not even get through half of them.
That's crazy. I'd love to go and try it. Yeah.
Yeah. I like made my husband come back, and we went and ate at a Peruvian restaurant while we were there, like my favorite Peruvian restaurant. Mm-hmm. And there's just I've never eaten food that good anywhere else. It's just this one tiny little restaurant.
What was it called?
It's called Taste of Peru. It's like a tiny little place. And I hope it stays like that, because it's such a, I just like the close knit of it, and the the guy who owns the restaurant is very nice and welcoming, and he tries to talk to you about everything, ask you questions about yourself, and yeah.
But yeah, but since the dawn of slavery, there's always been this racist idea that Black people are indefinitely stronger and therefore cannot feel pain. And so actually Thomas Jefferson actually publicized this claim and made it public knowledge that Black people cannot feel pain and therefore don't need rest and sleep. And so throughout that time, the black slaves would be worked from sun up to sundown. And so he kind of used that motive as a way to make it okay for slaves to be overworked. He made it seem like it was okay for them to be overworked, for them to be under poor conditions. And I think that's still shown in our medical system and the way Black women are treated in labor and the way the reform of the medical system. And also when they complain about being in physical pain, mentally, emotionally, they're always mm-hmm. looked as, oh, okay, it's not really that big of a deal, but we'll deal with that later. And so.
Yeah, I will. Like, I was going to say something about that.
Yeah. I just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, because as a nurse, like, we see that sometimes. Like, we'll, you know, we'll have, like, the last hospital I worked at was much more populated with, in the area where more Black people lived. Mm-hmm. And we saw sort of a difference, you know. And I think the thing is like Black women are just more vocal. They have no problem telling you, like, you know, what their symptoms are or how they feel about things. And they just might be louder, I mean, about it. And they're not the only group of people that do that. Like, Italian women are like that as well. And that's just a cultural thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think that a lot of people who aren't used to that, a lot of nurses who aren't used to that, when those types of women are crying out in pain and asking for help, they just think, oh, they're just being loud. They're just exaggerating. They're mm-hmm. fine, you know, and they won't immediately go and take care of the issue at hand. And so that's where we see like a breakdown. And that's one of the things that we've learned. We have all these lessons and continuing education courses on culture. And that's one of the things that we have to learn. But I wonder if some people just don't really, you know, they just take it and they don't even remember it and they don't really absorb it, you know. But like, I've noticed that, see, my husband is half Chinese mm-hmm. and Chinese people are very quiet about their symptoms and their suffering. So you have to basically, you know, without trying to push onto them things, you have to offer them multiple times, like, ways oh, wow. that they can get relief before they'll finally accept it.
And something I found that was really crazy is the fact that Black moms are twice as likely to have their infant die before their first birthday. That's crazy.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that. I know I've heard about, like, Black women having a lot of complications during their pregnancy, like when they're in the hospital, uh-huh. and because I think a lot of it is they're getting ignored and not, you know,
treated for their symptoms.
Yeah, because maybe their symptoms aren't taken seriously. I'm not sure, you know, 100% if that has to do with racism, but it could be just a cultural like breakdown in how the nonverbal and verbal communication is going on. But yeah, I did not know about the infant death. That is so awful. I wonder why.
Yeah. And to add to that, why do you think most abortion clinics are in minority neighborhoods and communities? Because that's something I found too. They're strategically placed for a reason. And if you didn't know this, abortion is the number one killer of Black people in this country.
That is so bad. That's so horrible. And do Black people acknowledge that, do you think? Or is it just like kind of...
It's not really talked about.
Are they just...
It's not really talked about. Yeah.
Because that's what I'm wondering. Like, I feel like that's one area where I can't just get on a platform and be like, okay, Black people, you need to stop having abortions. Like, I couldn't say anything to the community about that. But It would have to be, that would definitely have to be like another Black person talking to their own community about that for them to listen, I think, because, you know, as true as it is something that is hard to hear from a white person.
And the Black birth rates are also declining in this country, or they're basically staying at the same level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm curious also about your thoughts on Candace Owens. Because she talks about that a lot.
She does. Could you just refresh me a little bit? I'm not always up to date on certain topics.
Okay. So Candace Owens, she's a Black Republican. She kind of started the Black exit movement. She's gotten a lot of criticism recently because she criticized George Floyd and said like he wasn't a good person and we shouldn't lionize him or something like that. Yeah.
I've heard of her.
Yeah. So she got a lot of flack for that. But she's been talking a lot about Black abortions for a long time and about how the population is dropping. So I'm just curious. I mean, I don't agree with her on a lot of stuff, but I think she's probably right about that.
It's true. The white birth rate is in decline, and also the Black birth rate is going down because of abortions. You can look it up right now.
Mm. Yeah.
And there are multiple reasons why the white birth rate is going down and why in the past they try to stop abortions to get that birth rate up. But it's definitely a fact that you can look up right now. Why do you think there were so many bills in the past being passed to stop abortions, to get that white birth rate up? Even though 13% of the country is Black, 36% of the abortions are by Black women. What does that tell you about this country?
There's just so many things. We could go on for decades about these conversations, but
you could.
I think the key though really is, you know, why I wanted to talk about the Tuskegee experiment is really just to highlight how the government has used its own
power,
its scientific experts to kind of weaponize them against the population. Specific populations, not just in our country but in other countries, and it's not just like Black people, like I said. I mean, it's like the poor, it's the disenfranchised, it's the vulnerable, people who are the prisoners, the psychologically impaired. Yeah, it's been happening. It still has happened, maybe not so much in this country as you know recently. It's been mostly in Africa, but I wouldn't be surprised if this whole COVID thing is another way to just get the population to just be at heel and do what they say.
Definitely. And can I just ask you this?
Uh-huh.
What do you think was the good that came out of that experiment, if there was any good? What would you say is the good? Yeah, the Tuskegee experiment.
My hope. And maybe my hope for just this podcast, this episode right now, is that more Black people ask questions and they don't just blindly follow people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that they did with the Tuskegee experiment is they got their own doctor, their own nurse to kind of talk to the people and talk them into doing certain things like lay down, get your spinal tap, you know, go ahead and sign over your family's body so that we can cut its head open, things like that. They use their own people against them. So the same thing they do with every group that's disenfranchised,
being harmed.
A victim of the system. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, these are people who were sharecroppers. They don't read medical journals, you know.
They didn't know what was going on.
Go home.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't do that stuff because they're, at the end of the day, they're tired, they're going to go to sleep. So they rely on these experts to tell them what they need to know. But this is a different time, and we have the internet now. We have access to libraries. We have so much information at our fingertips now. We don't have to just sit down and just let these people tell us what to think and feel and what to do.
We have to come up and with our own opinions.
That's my hope. Exactly. So if anything came out of the Tuskegee experiment, hopefully it's that more Black people are asking questions and they're not just blindly following.
And are also aware of our history in this country. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and it's something that white people need to do too, because I see a hell of a lot of white people being stupid and talking about how they're just going to sit home until the vaccine shows up, because that's stupid too. But, you know, and I think, honestly, I don't think that, I think back then people were simple-minded in that they look at somebody who looks different and they think, well, that person looks different, so they must not be as smart as I am because I am this. But now we know better than that. And so now we look at different things besides just race now. We look at, are they living in Section 8 housing? Do they have multiple diagnoses for psychological issues? Has this person been in and out of prison? Oh, and are they in a place where the public school system sucks so bad that their education is terrible that they'll be easy to manipulate? So that's another thing to think about. Because I know in my area in East Tennessee, those people are white too. They're not just Black. That they fall in all those categories. They don't have a dad. They live in a Section 8 housing. They have poor education. They have poor diets. I mean, all kinds
goes
of,
on.
Yeah. So it's not. So I don't want to say that we need to focus so much on race anymore, but we do need to think about. I think that we need to think about the disenfranchised.
Yeah, and it's. And it's happening all over the world. It's not only in the U.S.
Yes.
And we need to focus on that because I think it's mostly happening in places like Africa, Asia, South America. And those people are helpless. No one's really checking and balancing what they're doing. And so they're just kind of vulnerable. People can come in and out and just do whatever they want. They can test on whoever they want without any repercussions. It's a sad reality.
Yeah. What I would love to do is if I was rich, I would love to just start an organization that just tried to bring, and maybe somebody's already tried to do this, I don't know, but just bring clean drinking water to these rural villages and teach these people how to read and write so if somebody like Bill Gates shows up and they want to give them all vaccines, they at least know how to read what they're signing themselves over to.
But sometimes they're forced. But that's another thing. Sometimes they're forced and coerced into doing it without their choice. So
that's so sad.
There's different levels. But this was definitely a great discussion. I enjoyed it. Thank you so much.
Yes. We need to have a lot more discussions like this. Definitely. Sure.
But thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Don't forget to send me a voice message and follow me on all my social media platforms, The Truth Disciple for Instagram and The Truth Disciple 1 for Twitter. If you enjoyed the podcast, please share, subscribe, and star my podcast on Anchor. And you can also support me monthly or DM me for more information about supporting the podcast. Remember, podcast today keeps the stupidity away. Thank you so much for listening and come back for another episode.